What a long, strange trip it's been for Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. She's been a state rep, a Jackson County legislator, a Jackson County prosecutor, a two-term state auditor, and now a two-term U.S. senator from one of the most competitive states in the country. McCaskill talks about how she navigated those years as a woman in what remains a political world dominated by men, and how she pulled off a huge upset in 2012 by defeating Todd Akin. It's all in a new memoir, Plenty Ladylike, that's just out. And she joins us now from NPR Studios in Washington. And Senator, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for taking some time.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be with you.
Well, you make no bones about your ambition for political office over the years, Senator. And I'm wondering, how okay is it today for a woman to be ambitious and to be seen as ambitious?
Well, that's kind of why I wrote the book.
Yeah.
I began by wanting to tell the amazing story of the 2012 election with all of its roller coaster-like efforts that took place in that election.
Oh, really? But, were there a few?
Yeah. Yeah, there were. There were a few. But the publisher who bought the book wanted to go further. And so I wanted to end up with a really candid, brutally candid, almost a blunt instrument candid account of that I was ambitious from a very young age. And I was told to be quiet. I was told that I was not going to be liked by the boys. I was told that it wasn't ladylike. And then on things that happened to me along the way, and I hope at the end of this book, young women who read it will say, okay, being ambitious is good. It is ladylike. Being outspoken, trying to change the world, being opinionated, all the things that our culture has kind of looked down their nose at when women have embraced these characteristics, I'm hopeful that this will encourage young women that they should go for it.
Why were you able to embrace those ideas and survive, even in an era when being ambitious and having the big blonde mane of hair that you write about in the book, you know, sort of sets you up for criticism and sort of you were asking for it back in those days, if, you know, in the world of Jefferson City politics? How did you survive it?
Well, I mean, hopefully, I'm not sure I did it right. I talk about that in the book, that I didn't confront it. I'm very proud of the young lady who came forward with her allegation of sexual harassment in Jefferson City. In fact, the women that came forward, because
that was in the Kansas City Star, and I had a hand in that story. Yeah.
Yeah. And two politicians lost their job over inappropriate behavior with interns this last session. I didn't confront folks when I was an intern. I didn't even confront them when I was a state legislator. I laughed, but I internalized it and became hyper-focused on doing well, blowing past these jerks that were making jokes that I didn't think were so funny, but I pretended to laugh along, even though I thought they were ridiculously inappropriate. And I talk about some of those things in the book, and I do it so that maybe young women today will see that it can strengthen your resolve. It can make you more determined and more focused. And maybe I should have confronted it more openly.
I was going to say, even though you say in the book you're not sure you handled it the right way.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe it would have been better for me to confront Bob Griffin when he told me made the snide comment that he was, you know, that he made to me that was out of bounds.
He's a former House Speaker who addressed you on the dais of the House of Representatives in Jefferson City. Yeah.
Yeah. When I went up to ask him how I could get my first bill out of committee, he laughed and said, "Did you bring your knee pads?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, I walked away, and I don't think he knew I was offended, but I was, and I just made up my mind that I would work that much harder, that I wasn't going to let folks marginalize me, that I was going to be determined. So it really did give me fuel for my ambition, those things. But I'm proud of the young women today who are confronting it head on. And obviously, I think a deterrent effect is that these politicians lost their jobs and their careers over it.
Would you be a two-term U.S. senator today if you had confronted the Bob Griffins of Jefferson City in a different way back in those days?
I don't know. That's a really good question, Steve. I honestly don't know. I think the most important thing I had going for me was an upbringing by both a mother and a father who kept reassuring me that I was great and could do wonderful things. And my dad was particularly important because I had a hard time getting dates, both in high school and college. And I was, you know, and he kept saying, you know, Claire, don't dumb down. Men will figure it out eventually. Strong men will be attracted to you. And don't worry about the men who think you're too opinionated or too aggressive. It'll all be fine. And his reassurance was incredibly important to me because, it was hard. Mm-hmm. There is a temptation to be more demure and kind of dumb down so that I was not off-putting to men. But as he was right, it all worked out. It all worked out.
I'm visiting with Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill about her new memoir, Plenty Ladylike. You know, we're talking about how ambition is becoming more accepted for women these days. You know, given that, then how do you explain Donald Trump's rise in the polls, you know, given his past remarks about women that were so publicly aired in last week's GOP presidential debate? I mean, is his rise, is it a setback for women?
Well, I think if he became president, it would. But frankly, I looked at some of the other Republicans and some of the things they said that were overlooked because of Donald Trump's bluster. He's getting all the oxygen in the room at this point, and I think the voters are not really focusing on some of the other things that are being said by the other candidates that are very, I think, offensive to a lot of women, like Marco Rubio saying in the debate that he would be the first Republican candidate for president in modern not support an exception for rape and incest in abortion and restrictions. That's a remarkable position for him to stake out, and it didn't even get noticed in all of the Trump mania.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here's the thing with Trump. I don't respect Trump, but I respect the voters who are supporting him. Because I understand it. There is such a sense of cynicism and negativity towards Washington writ large. And there's such a sense that the government is not functioning the way it should. There's such a sense that it's being co-opted by money and dark money and all of that. That people who are really want to shake things up, they want to go for someone who they believe is really going to shake things up. And that's why I think Trump is so attractive to many voters right now. And I respect that. I get that. Hopefully by the end of the day, everyone will realize we've got to have strength and stability in the Oval Office. And I don't think, while he's getting 22%, 24% of the Republican primary voters, that means there's 75% of the Republican primary voters that are rejecting him.
Yeah.
And that's a big number for him to overcome in a race with as many candidates as this one.
So his odds of becoming the GOP nominee in your mind would be what?
If I had to bet, I'd say it's 10-1.
Yeah.
Pretty long odds.
Yeah. I want to go back to the book and your Jefferson City days because I was there for some of those.
You were.
Days.
That's how old you are, Steve Kraske. Yeah, you were actually a reporter in Jefferson City when I came there.
That's supposed to be a secret.
You must have been 14.
I was. It's for the record.
There you
I was.
Go.
I was. There
I was
a boy wonder back in those days. Now, you had problems with a group of six male lawyers who were lawmakers who called themselves the Six Pack. And I should point out that we have an excerpt from Plenty Ladylike on our website right now, kcur.org, that deals with this part of Senator McCaskill's career. They weren't particularly nice to you. In fact, they excluded you. What did they do, and how did you deal with them?
Well, I didn't even realize it was going on, although there were some things that happened. Like, I remember distinctly, I was trying to get a bill out of the Civil and Criminal Justice Committee, and all of a sudden, one of my attorney colleagues in my freshman class did a motion to table. Well, nobody did a motion to table in committee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tactic that evidently had been plotted out ahead of time by these six lawyers who were socializing with each other and called themselves the six pack. And of course, there were seven lawyers in our freshman class. I was the seventh. So I was not part of the six pack. Eventually, Doug Harpool, who was one of the six pack, came to me and told me about it because it was making him uncomfortable. And it was startling to me that there had been this group that was socializing and going to dinner and having fun and in the process tormenting me slightly. And it was just one of another example of when I just made up my mind to continue to try to be as nice as I could to everybody, work as hard as I could, and figure out a way to maneuver around that obstacle. And I managed to do that.
Now, you write this in the book, Senator, and this surprised me, given my time spent covering you and observing you in so many public settings over the year. You write this: I spent more time behind closed doors in my office crying than people realized at the time. What made you cry back then?
Well, I want to be liked. Mm-hmm. I think particularly people who go into politics have probably an unhealthy need to be liked. And it was hurtful. It was just flat hurtful sometimes. I knew I couldn't be emotional about it as I did my work. So when it became overwhelming, I would go to the privacy of my office and have a good cry. It's one of the reasons women live longer than men. We cry more. But I didn't want everybody to know that I was crying, so I didn't share it with anyone. But I put it in the book because I don't think young women should be embarrassed about feeling emotional about obstacles that pop up that hurt them.
Yeah.
And the fact that these guys in my class were all kind of a band together and I had been excluded, it was a little junior high-ish, but nonetheless, just like in junior high, it kind of hurt my feelings. Yeah. And there were other things like that along the way that I got really frustrated. I was not given a committee chairmanship as soon as my colleagues in my class were. That was hurtful. The speaker told me it was because I was too independent. That was really irritating to me. So there were things like that happened that just flat hurt my feelings, and I cried.
A few minutes ago, we were talking about the fact that these stories I worked on for the newspaper with Jason Hancock, the Star is still writing these stories, talking about these issues still going on in Jefferson City, 20, 25, 30 years since you were last there. And I'm wondering, the fact that the atmosphere, the culture hasn't changed that much over the years, what do you make of that? And what does that say about us?
It's not good.
Yeah.
It says that folks who get elected sometimes, especially when they're away from home in an artificial bubble, and this is true whether you're in Washington or whether you're in Jefferson City, there's this sense within the building that you're invincible. Mm-hmm. That you are so powerful, that you are so important, and combine that, and especially in Jefferson City, we can't even take a lunch from a lobbyist, and we have such strict gift rules in Washington, but in Jefferson City, they can buy you anything, unlimited gifts. So the alcohol flows, the nice dinners and parties flow, all paid for by lobbyists, and in that stew of invincibility and power and lots of people bowing and scraping to you and buying you stuff, I think people make bad choices. Now, I do think these young women coming forward like they have this year is really going to make a difference, because if there's one thing the folks in Jefferson City don't want, and that is their career to crash and burn. Look at Speaker Deal.
Yeah,
he was, at the top of the heap. And maybe there's a pattern there that people who get to the top of the heap sometimes lose the most perspective about what's appropriate and what isn't.
At the end of this book, you write about lessons learned over the arc of your career. And one lesson for women is this: don't be afraid to offend. That seems strange, coming from a politician. So what did you mean by that?
Well, the need to appease is something that it's almost I call it the disease to appease. Women, I think, are very reluctant to have people not like them. And it is impossible to get anything done, particularly in my chosen profession, without making people mad. And in a way, I'm blessed because I'm from a state that it is impossible not to make people mad because it's so divided. And so I've gotten very used to hateful things being said about me and to me, unfair things written about me. And it's okay. And I think women need to get comfortable with that. I think men are much more comfortable. Maybe it's because of, that they are something in the different genetic makeup and hormonal makeup means confrontation is more comfortable for them. But confrontation and offending people are necessary ingredients to getting anything done, and they certainly are necessary ingredients to being a leader. So I hope that from the book, folks will, especially young women, will take that.
Senator Claire McCaskill is my guest. Her new book, her new memoir, Plenty Ladylike. I'll be talking to Senator McCaskill a second time on Sunday, 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at Unity Temple on the Plaza. It's an event co-sponsored by the Star and Rainy Day Books. To get a seat for that event, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. You say in the book that you talked to President Obama in 2011, now a year before your reelection year. You were in the White House. You talked to him about leaving the Senate and not running again. How close did you come to actually packing it in?
You know, I talk about it in the book, and it is hard sometimes. I am not sure that people realize how schedule driven my work is. I do not have control of my schedule. I am required to be lots of places, lots of times, and it is. And I've done it for a long, long time. And so I was tired, and I knew that there was going to be literally tens upon millions of dollars spent trying to distort who I was and what my record represented. And I just was tired. And I went. The president asked me to lunch every once in a while, and we eat in his little private dining room off the Oval. And we had one of those great personal lunches where it wasn't about what I should do, what I could do, but, you know, what do you feel like doing? And we talked as friends rather than as him being the president and the head of my party. And it was great because I think he gave me good personal advice. And I told him at the end of the lunch, as I talk about in the book, hey, if you come to Missouri, don't make the mistake you made for Robin Carnahan and say that you needed me for a vote. And he reassured me he could not do that because I was way too big of a pain to him, because I'm constantly telling him that I think he's wrong and voting against some of the things he wants me to vote for.
What was that like for you, you know, a kid from Missouri sitting in the president's personal dining room?
Hey, listen, I am so grateful to the people of Missouri. I can get emotional about it, to have the opportunities I've had. And some of it is as simple as being able to get the Purple Heart for a veteran who never received it. Some of it is as thrilling as, you know, having the president sing happy birthday to me on Air Force One on my 60th birthday, bringing me a cupcake with a candle in it. I've had some amazing, amazing experiences, and I am being part of the Obama's presidency in terms of his campaign, being involved in his campaign and becoming friends with this man has been a terrific experience. He isn't perfect. He's made a lot of mistakes, and he will tell you I'm one of the first ones to tell him when I think he's making a mistake. But I still get goosebumps when I drive to the Capitol early in the morning, and when the sun comes up in Washington and you're driving towards the Capitol, the dome kind of turns pink, and I still get goosebumps. I'm the luckiest woman on the planet. I have a wonderful family and a really interesting job that the people of Missouri have blessed me with, and I try to pinch myself every day.
You know, one other purpose to this book is to shed more light on your fascinating, you know, the 2012 reelection race against Todd Akin. It's become the stuff of political legend already, and that you weighed in and you actually bought TV ads to help Todd Akin. In the book, though, you reveal that you went farther and you advised the Akin camp about the importance of running a certain ad that was proving effective to him and that the campaign had taken off the air. And you actually let your pollster speak to Akin's campaign. So there was no doubt in your mind that Todd Akin was the Republican you wanted to face that year?
No doubt. He's a principled guy. He has very deeply held beliefs. I believe that many of them are way outside the mainstream. I was confident that Missourians would reject many of his views. He had spoken derogatorily of Medicare and Social Security, said college loans were a cancer of socialism. Lots of things that, you know, you'd scratch your head and go, what? And he had that record. And I knew he would speak forcefully about these things. He was somebody who wasn't going to be told to be quiet about it in order to win. So I definitely knew he was the opponent we wanted and we needed. And he didn't have as much money as the other two candidates. And so I said, let's poll and see what Republicans like about him. And as it turned out, we figured out that they did really like some things about him, like that he had said Barack Obama is a menace to society, things like that. These are Republican primary voters. And so we decided, let's just cut an ad where I say he's too conservative and lay out these things that Republican primary voters like about him. And
all in an attempt to get him elected.
Correct. And it worked because first people, if I was saying he was too conservative, that was like a stamp of approval to Republican primary voters because it's not like they were loving on me. And secondly, the things that we put in the ad were things that they liked about him. And so we spent more money. And it, by the way, this was all Front Street. There was no, you know, behind the scenes or sneaky stuff here. It was paid for by Claire McCaskill. I approve this message. And it worked. It started moving him in the polls. And we spent more than he had spent in the entirety of his primary on these ads. We spent $1.7 million. I believe that it had a key role in him winning that primary.
You know, some folks have said you were cheating. By engaging in a Republican primary, you were sort of breaching the ethics of politics and doing something that was, you know, not ethical. What do you say to that?
I think, listen, there have been men throughout the history of our country that have engaged in high-level strategic decisions in campaigns. There is nothing I did that wasn't by the book. These ads were completely transparent. It was very obvious to anybody who watched the ad that I had paid for the ad. So to the extent that a Republican voter would look at that and go, well, if Claire McCaskill paid for it, maybe we ought to think twice about what she's trying to tell us. And I'm sure some voters did see that and decided that maybe Todd Akin wasn't the one they were going to vote for. So I this is really why I included it in the book. I want women to be more strategic. I mean, look at Jeff Rowe, for God's sake. I mean, here's Jeff Rowe. He's running Ted Cruz's campaign.
He's the Kansas City area political operative on the Republican side, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's Mr. Dirty Tricks. You should see the stuff he's done to me over the years. It's disgusting. And he usually sneaks around and does it. You know, you can't tell who's paying for it. You can't tell where it's coming from. He puts this horrible stuff out on blogs. Give me a break. These guys now saying that somehow I'm unethical because I ran an ad with my name on it and it worked, I think it's sour grapes.
And today, as you're hearing, some Republicans are also saying now that what you did violates campaign law because it amounts to illegal coordination. What do you say to that?
That's silly. I mean, it's just silly. Yeah, these guys, they haven't read the law. They don't know the law. I was giving advice. A candidate can give an advice to another candidate anytime. I gave advice to a candidate. It was his. He certainly had a choice of rejecting it. It was coming from me, after all.
Yeah.
But it was just advice, and we didn't give him any polling data. I mean, it was just generalities. So there was absolutely nothing that was done here. And this is just those folks reading what we did and being, you know, kind of angry and having sour grapes that we pulled it off.
Yeah. So you promised your family that if Todd Akin won the Republican primary, you would shotgun a beer, which you did. What is that, shotgunning a beer, and what was that all about?
Well, first of all, let me point out, I didn't know what it was either, because I want to reassure listeners.
Yeah.
I had beer, but my daughters are in their 20s, and they were with me that summer on the campaign, which was, you know, one of the highlights of my career, is to have my two daughters campaigning with me. And they saw how stressed I was and this high-risk strategy we were embracing. And so Maddie, my middle child, said to me, Mom, it's the primary. On that night, will you shotgun a beer with us? I said, well, I don't know what it is, but if he wins the primary, I'll do it. So sure enough, that night, they showed me you stick a hole in the bottom of the beer can, and then you put it over your mouth, and then you pull the tab of the beer, and that pressure shoots the beer down your throat. And that's what I did.
That's what you did.
And won the primary.
Yeah. Did you think the election was over at that point, or was it not that simple? That now you were facing Todd Akin. Where was your head?
No, I didn't think it was over. Now, the day after the primary, he went on radio and said that he did not support the rape and incest exception, which was notable. Then a few days later, he said he didn't support school lunch program, which was notable. So it was a gift that began to give. But then, of course, he said legitimate rape. And the chapter in the book is called The Magic Uterus, where he talked about legitimate rape shutting down a woman's body so that she couldn't get pregnant. And then that just blew up. And from that point on, it got much, much easier. But up until he said that, the race was still close, and the money was pouring in from Karl Rove and everybody. It was quite, it was going to be, continue to be a battle. I was confident we could win. Frankly, I believed we could have beat the other two also, because their views were very similar to Todd Akin's. I mean, John Bruner has some really extreme views. Sarah Steelman had some things that she said that were pretty extreme. So I think we could have beaten all three of them, but certainly Todd ended up exceeding our expectations in terms of what he said during the campaign, and that made it much easier.
So you're sitting at home, if I remember the story correctly, in St. Louis, when Akin, his interview appeared on the air where he used the phrase legitimate rape for the first time. What went through your mind when you heard him say that? How did the politician in you respond to that?
Well, I wasn't watching, because we had looked at the promo for the interview, and what they promoed was not this. I mean, Jayco kind of missed that this was as outrageous.
Charles Jayco, the interviewer over
there. Yeah, the interviewer. So we didn't know this was in the interview. So my staff was, you know, somebody was assigned to watch it and take notes. And so I got an email after the interview was over and said, you know, he just said legitimate rape shuts down the woman's body so she can't get pregnant. And I emailed my staff back and just said, light him up on this. Well, little did I know that there was another group that was watching what he said, and then they started lighting him up nationally, and it started spreading virally. And by that night, it was trending number one internationally on Twitter. And so it spread like wildfire in this day of viral activity on the internet. And it, you know, I'll never forget, I was riding to the studio with what he'd said on a 3x5 card with my daughter, trying to memorize it, because I was worried people wouldn't realize what he actually said. Little did I know it was going to play over and over and over again on a loop for the next 2 weeks.
You know, all this makes me wonder, a political reporter like myself, do you have a third Senate race in you in 2018?
I think I do. I think I do. I mean, I've gotten very, you know, I hope Missourians have gotten to know me. I've, you know, been pretty independent. I've tried to chart my own course. I try to call them like I see them. I hope I'm forthcoming. I work hard. So I think I do. It's too early to decide, but there is some pull on me. I will acknowledge that I've got this wonderful family. We have a blended family of 7 children. I now have 9 grandchildren that I need to influence as much as possible about being strong and assertive and going out and changing the world. So that's a pull. And the schedule does get it's sometimes hard, because I'm away from home so often. I come out to Washington every week, come home every weekend. It's an awful lot of travel.
Yeah.
But I still have such work to do. There's a lot of work to do. And I want to be part of a moderate middle that brings the two ends together and compromise. So, you know, I think I probably do have another race in me.
Senator, you have to go in just a half a second here, but a couple quick issues. One that hangs out there is the Iraq nuclear pact, the Iranian nuclear decision on the agreement that President Obama has made here. Where do you stand on that thing?
I am. There is no question that if we do this deal, Iran is going to get not $150 billion, but $60 billion, which is bad. I'm trying to figure out, we don't hold this money, and I'm taking this time to talk to the countries that do hold the money, because what I got to know is, are they going to give this money to Iran if we don't do the deal? Is Iran going to get this money anyway?
Because these are asset countries you're talking about.
Correct.
That are being held because of what Iran's been doing in recent years, the bad behavior.
Because of the sanctions.
Yeah.
Because they have voluntarily respected the United States sanctions, and this is Japan, South Korea, Turkey, India, China. These are the countries primarily that hold the $60 billion. So I am calling all of those ambassadors and asking them point blank, will you continue to hold the Iranian money if the United States does not become a part of this deal? And if they are not clear that they're going to continue to hold the money, then I'm going, really? we're going to let them get $60 billion and not put cement down their centrifuges? That doesn't sound like a good idea. So that's what I'm busy doing. We got 60 days to look at this deal. I plan on taking as much as I need. I've been disappointed. Most of the Republicans, it appeared, made up their mind in 5 minutes.
And finally, Planned Parenthood. Lots of controversy about the videos that have appeared about fetal body parts being on the market. Should Planned Parenthood be sanctioned? Should they be penalized? Where do you come down?
Well, I believe that the Attorney General is doing an investigation in Missouri. That Planned Parenthood has said that they do not even have such a program in Missouri. I think most affiliates of Planned Parenthood don't have a fetal tissue research program that they ask patients if they want to participate in. Here's my take on this. We do not give them any money to do abortions. Absolutely none. This is all money for birth control. I think we all ought to unite around the notion we want to prevent abortions. We don't prevent abortions by denying Planned Parenthood birth control money. Birth control prevents abortions. We should be putting birth control funds out on the street as much as we can so we have fewer abortions.
You can see and hear Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, 2 o'clock Sunday, Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. Call Rainy Day Books and Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. Senator, always great to have you. Thanks for taking some time today. I'll see you on Sunday, okay?
I'll see you Sunday, Steve.
You bet.
Thanks.
Take care, Senator. Bye-bye.